This is a Particle podcast. WA Science told different. Powered by SciTech.
Please Look Up is recorded at SciTech on Whadjuk Noongar land. Good evening, everybody. My name is Leon.
And I'm Beth.
And welcome back to Please Look Up, your monthly deep dive into space news.
And commentary.
Recorded at SciTech on Whadjuk Noongar land. Beth, thanks for being here again. It's a pleasure to be here myself.
Thank you for having me, Leon. But what's up this month?
The question that defines our lives. What's up this month? Yes, if you're looking up in the night sky this month, I think it's all about the Milky Way in winter.
Yeah.
So we've obviously, July brings us nicely into winter, and it is the best time of the year to see the Milky Way galaxy.
Why?
Why? Good question. Because as Earth orbits the sun, our view of the night sky changes depending on where around the sun the Earth is.
Yeah, so that's why we can see some constellations at some times of year and some constellations at different times of year.
Yes, that's exactly right. Cool. And along with the changing constellations comes the sort of changing field of stars as well. And it just happens to be that during this time of the year, it's not just July, but it's around about the middle of the year, that our view of the night sky, Earth happens to be pointing pretty much exactly towards the brightest parts of the Milky Way, if you're down here in Australia.
Right, which I guess is slightly frustrating for us because it's winter, which means it's also the time of year it's most likely to be covered with clouds.
Yes, we have this irony. The best time of the year to look at the night sky for the Milky Way is also the worst time of the year to look at the night sky. But if you can get out and away from the city lights, you don't have to get far to even get a half-decent view. You'll just notice that there are there's just so many more stars visible than typical, and that the bright smudge of the Milky Way is kind of stretching all the way across the sky. You know, in summer it's very low on the horizon, this sort of the bright smudge, and, you know, during autumn and spring it's kind of at halfway up, but during winter it's stretched right across the sky, right above your heads.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so for the best view, you know, try and get away from the city, try and go camping, or, you know, just drive for half an hour out away from the brightest parts of the city, and you'll be able to see this beautiful galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, stretching across the sky.
Oh, that's awesome. I think one of the things that I really love as well about when you can get away from those city lights, and again, it's a lot easier at this time of year, is if you can see the Milky Way, it's a very, very bright, very long smudge going across the whole sky. But if you're facing south and you look sort of further down in the sky than the Milky Way, sometimes you can see the clouds. But not clouds.
Oh, you're talking about the Magellanic Clouds.
I am talking about the Magellanic Clouds, which is hard to say.
Yes.
And also is a complete misnomer, because they're not clouds.
They're not clouds. Well, you've led us in this direction, Beth. What are the Magellanic Clouds?
So the Magellanic Clouds are dwarf galaxies. Mm. So there's a large one and a small one. And I think that the large one looks a little bit like a lobster.
I guess it does, actually. I've seen lots of pictures of it. It does look a bit like a lobster.
Yeah, it's sort of lobster-shaped. Yeah, and so most of the time you'll only be able to see a couple of smudges in the sky, a slightly bigger smudge and a slightly smaller smudge. But yeah, they're dwarf galaxies, so they're galaxies like ours, except a lot smaller. And the large and small Magellanic Clouds are actually in orbit around our galaxy. So they're in orbit around the Milky Way. So they sort of follow us around the universe. They are in the influence of the Milky Way's gravity.
Yeah, in much the same way the moon orbits the Earth, the Magellanic Clouds orbit the Milky Way. It's just on a galactic scale. And you said these are like low down in the south, is that right?
Yes. So if you've got the Milky Way above you and you could find the Southern Cross, you can do our neat little trick of drawing a little line through the Southern Cross and finding your pointer stars and drawing a line through them, and it'll point you in the right direction. That means you're looking south, and the large and small Magellanic Clouds should hopefully be around there somewhere.
Yes, they are. Having seen them myself as well, yeah, they're quite faint, but I know what you mean. They look like smudges or clouds, perhaps.
Yeah.
But just keep an eye on them for a while, and you'll see they're not moving or changing with the weather.
And yeah.
Yeah, those are the dwarf galaxies you can see.
I just think it's awesome that we can see other galaxies from Earth.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I know that in the Northern Hemisphere, sometimes you can see Andromeda as well, but like naked eye, Southern Hemisphere, being able to see another galaxy, it's just awesome.
And the Magellanic Clouds are so far south that most observers in the Northern Hemisphere have never seen them.
I'd never seen them before I moved here.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. So yeah, well, worth getting out. You can see three galaxies, our galaxy and the two neighbouring ones.
Three whole galaxies in one night sky. What a treat.
It's very special. technically they're out every night, but as I said, this is the best time of year to see them. Now, as that's your sort of broad blue sky astronomy, there, I suggest, or night sky astronomy. There are a couple of planets that you can still see, or that you can see. So remember, perhaps you remember last month I mentioned right at the end of June we were getting a really lousy view of Mercury.
Yes, yeah, and also having to wake up at ridiculous times to be able to see any decent planets.
Yes, well, guess what? In July, you can still get a lousy view of Mercury.
Oh.
It's slightly better. So just after sunset, in the sort of hour after sunset during July, you'll be able to see Mercury on the horizon, on the western horizon. So it's chasing the sun over the horizon.
Okay.
Mercury's never far from the sun and in the sky. So that's why you can only see it after sunset. Or just before sunrise. In this case, for July, for the first few weeks of July, it's just after sunset, you'll see Mercury. It is moving night after night, so it moves quite quickly, and it doesn't hang around the whole month, so you've only got a couple of weeks to really see it. It's quite low on the horizon. However, as the month goes on, you will start to see another very, very bright object appear on the western horizon. It's moving up almost in the opposite direction. It's moving up higher and higher in the sky.
Can I guess?
Take a guess.
I genuinely have no idea. Is it Venus?
It is Venus.
Yeah!
Yes, the evening star.
Hey,
that's a star.
That's why I thought it was that. I was like, oh, a very bright light in the evening? Venus!
Could it be? Yes, you're right. And Venus still orbits closer to the sun than Earth does, but it's further out than Mercury. And for that reason, it moves slower and it moves higher up in the sky. And as a result, it stays around a lot longer. In fact, Venus will be in the western sky after sunset for about the next 6 months.
So with the planets in general, looking for them in the sky, their proximity to the sun in the solar system, that affects their proximity to the sun in our night sky?
Yes, absolutely right. So if you think, for example, like Mercury or Venus, they are closer to the sun than us, which means if you want to look in the general direction of Mercury or Venus, you need to be looking in the general direction of the sun as well.
Yeah.
And so that means, they're never far from the sun in the night sky because they're never in the daytime sky as well, because they're never far from the sun in real life. And that's why it's quite difficult to observe them. Another way of saying this is you will never ever see Mercury or Venus at midnight, because what does it mean to see something at midnight? It means you're in the middle and the sun is on one side,
opposite side,
and the planet is on the other side, and Earth can never get in between Mercury and the sun or Venus and the sun, which is why you can never see Mercury or Venus at midnight, unlike, for example, all the other planets, which are further away. Not all at the same time, but you can see other planets at midnight, depending on where they're up to in their orbits, because, they can be on other sides of the sun from Earth.
Oh, that's cool. Does that... Because I know that Venus is very, very bright in the night sky. Is that because of how close it is to the sun then?
Partially. It's a bit of both. But it's not just that, because Mercury, on the other hand, is not as bright as Venus, but it is close to the sun. It's a little bit of everything. Absolutely, yes, its proximity to the sun does make a difference because it's getting a lot of light.
Yeah.
And therefore it has...
A lot to reflect.
A lot to reflect, yes. But it also is also helped by the fact that Venus's atmosphere is covered, there's a lot of clouds on Venus's atmosphere.
Right.
And those clouds happen to be quite reflective. And that's why we... So, it also depends on the reflectivity. Compared to if Venus had a totally dark surface that just absorbed all the light, it would be a little bit harder to see in the sky.
Yeah, because I guess, even if you compare, Mars and Jupiter, Mars stands out because it's red, but it's not a very bright red, whereas Jupiter does look quite bright in the night sky. But it's a very cloudy planet.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that comes down to a bit of both. And Jupiter is a lot bigger than Mars.
Yes.
So it has a lot more surface area to collect and then reflect that light back out. But yes, you're right. When we're seeing the light from Mars, we're seeing the light that is reflected off the ground of Mars, which is not really as reflective as the clouds of Jupiter. Or in this other example, the clouds of Venus. And in fact, after the sun and the moon, the two brightest objects in the night sky that you'll see are Jupiter and Venus.
Oh.
So, and partially is because of the reflection of the clouds. Part of it is their size. Part of it is their proximity to the sun. There's no single thing that makes them that bright.
It's a combination of factors.
That's right. It'd be nice for me to have a nice simple answer. This is why. But it's, it's a little bit of everything.
Well, but I guess clouds contribute to brightness, which seems backwards here on Earth, when it's cloudy.
It's dark.
Although, to be fair though, sometimes when it's cloudy, you go outside and it's cloudy, but you still need sunglasses because it's yeah. bright and dark at the same time.
That's true. Or have you ever been on an aeroplane that's flying above a storm?
Yeah.
And it's really bright because there's a lot of light bouncing off the top of those clouds, yeah. which is why it's dim down on the ground because yeah. a lot of the light's bouncing back out.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, awesome. Thanks. And sorry, I completely derailed our talk about other planets there. I was just curious about brightness and whiteness.
Absolutely. So yeah, Mercury and Venus in the western sky in the evening after mm-hmm. sunset during July. Mercury won't be there for long, but Venus will be there for months, so don't worry if you miss it. In fact, it's probably only going to get better over the next few months. But if you want to see the other planets, like Jupiter that we've just been talking about, Mars, you know the drill. Get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Feels bad, man. Well, actually, I should clarify. Jupiter and Mars, yeah, they're up in the morning sky in the east, so the other side of the sky. Jupiter is by far the brightest. Mars will obviously have that reddish tinge. And, yeah, they're up at about 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, give or take half an hour and until sunrise happens. Saturn is kind of exactly in the middle. Saturn is technically rising at about 10 p.m.
Okay.
However, like any rising planet, it takes an hour or two for it to get high enough above the horizon for it to have an actual decent view.
Yeah.
So you either need to be up late or up early. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning is probably the best time to see Saturn.
A perfectly reasonable time of day.
Exactly. So, you can also, if you're one of those monsters who goes out at 6 o'clock in the morning to look at Jupiter and Mars, you'll also get a good view of Saturn too.
Oh, that's good. So if I am up very early in the morning, which I'm not, but someone might be, mm-hmm. I'm looking in the east for Jupiter and Mars.
Yes.
And then Saturn will be more above my head?
Yeah, more above your head, sort of towards the north a little bit.
Okay.
But north-ish, northwest maybe. But, you know, it depends on the time of day.
Yeah.
It's definitely, you know, a couple of months ago it was noticeably not too far from Jupiter and Mars over in the east.
Mm.
But over time it's, you know,
it's
the planets have moved and things like that. So it's now kind of just distinct on its own.
Cool. So we've had some planets, we've had some galaxies. What else is going on in the night sky?
Well, I want to draw us now to a constellation.
The constellation?
It's the
constellation. Now, really quickly, I have thoughts about what the constellation of the month should be mm-hmm. because July is my birthday.
Ah, it is.
So for me, the constellation of the month should be Leo.
Yeah, okay, that's nice.
Astrologically, I'm a Leo. Oh yeah, Leon, I'm bringing in your least favourite part of things related to space and constellations.
Oh dear, astrology. Well, I'd like to point out my birthday's in July as well, and I'm making the executive decision that I don't really care.
Cool. Yeah, that's fair.
No, fire away. What's your questions about that, or is it just a wind?
Oh no,
me up?
Just it should be. Oh. I'm just winding you up. Yeah. No, I think there is one thing that I did want to ask about that, though. So I was born in the Northern Hemisphere, and in the Northern Hemisphere, in July, it's not actually the best time of year to see the constellation of Leo. Mm. So it would make more sense to me if you look up into the night sky and can see the constellation that is associated with your star sign.
Yeah.
It would seem to make sense.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
No, in fact, it's almost the exact opposite.
Yeah.
It's almost the worst time of year to see that particular constellation. We might have to visit this in more detail in a later episode.
See, what I've done, everyone, is I've trapped Leon by asking him a question about astrology, and guess what? He knows the answer, which is going to make him a little bit angry at himself.
No, I thought it's important to understand why it's not real or magical or not going to change your life. What it is so you've all seen the models of the solar system where you have the sun and then all the planets go around
mm-hmm.
and the planets all orbit in the same plane. They're all level. They don't go up and down and sideways and backwards.
Yeah.
They're all in the same sort of, you know, the solar system's quite egg-shaped.
It's a plate with some peas on it.
Yes, that's right. Or a fried egg, as I like to think. And what that means is as the Earth orbits the sun and you look at all the other planets and the positions of them, the background stars in the background of your observations is only a very small part of the sky. It's like a very, you know, this strip around the sun of stars
yeah.
that can be in the background. So The Southern Cross, for example, can never be in the background of a planet because this plate of
the solar system... Yes, the plate is not in line with the Southern Cross.
That's right. Nor is it in line with the Big Dipper or our constellation of the month last month, the Hydra. You'll never find a planet in the constellation of Hydra. However, of those constellations that you do find it in, those have over time been recognised as what we now call the zodiac constellations.
Right.
And many, many thousands of years ago, people noticed that you can define certain seasons by not only the weather, but also the position of the sun in that time of year. And so that's where the date sort of came down. So thousands of years ago, if the sun happened to be the background stars were the stars of Leo, people would say, oh, you were born underneath Leo.
Oh, so when the sun is in
the
Leo,
sun is in, so ironically,
I am a Leo.
That's right, at midday.
At midday.
Yes.
That's thoroughly unhelpful.
Yes. However, a few thousand years ago, people noticed, oh, you know what? According to our calendar, it's actually the same dates every year. So let's just cement those dates in. And now we'll just forget about the sun and the stars and we'll just remember the dates. And so anyone born in these dates, should be right. Yeah. The problem is that the sun and the solar system and everything's not static. And over those thousands of years, everything has shifted a bit. So all those dates are now just off. And the position of Leo when you were born is actually not where it was thousands of years.
Right.
So I don't even know what constellation you were born underneath, quote unquote. All I can say for a fact is that every single person who thinks they have a star sign and thinks that it means something, they're all off. They're all wrong. Which I like to think the good way about that is if you go to the newspaper and they're like, you'll have a two-star day or something. What you do is you ignore that one and pick one of the other ones at random that's got
a good day.
Because there's a 1 in 11 chance that's correct. Whereas if you read the one that's your star sign, quote unquote, it's 100% wrong.
Almost definitely incorrect.
Yes. So that's my take on all of that.
I just like lions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what's my name? Look, it's interesting, and it does show that once upon a time, astrology and astronomy were not that different, and they were based on the observations of the stars.
Yeah.
It's just in its modern woo interpretation, it's gotten so lost from its origins that it now is just a pile of nonsense. But, you know, thousands of years ago, when people in the days of ye old, they needed to know, when should I plant my crops? Oh, I don't know how to read a calendar, but I do know when that star is there, and that star is my symbol. I'll make a mental note. Every time I see that star each year, it's time to plant my crops.
Well, there's a lot of stars and constellations that in different cultures, like the name of the star might mean... Sirius, the dog star, is associated with the dog days, which is summertime in the Northern Hemisphere.
Right, there you go.
Is it? Winter. Oh, now I'm getting all mixed up.
Spring or something. The sighting of Sirius was the time to harvest your crops or plant them, one or the other, I can't remember.
Yeah, exactly. So the people have assigned stars meaning for very, very important things throughout history. And I love how, like, I really enjoy how that has filtered through. I think it's very silly, but it's also... it's quite romantic. I quite enjoy it. And to be honest, if it's getting people looking up at the night sky... good.
I agree with you 100% on that. I just don't think it does. And, and the other problem being is that, if you read it and you know it's a little bit of a joke and you're like, oh, I'm going to have a bad day today because the paper says so, that's fine. But if you're like making serious life decisions based on what someone has written from artificialintelligence.com, write me a star sign, and then you're like, oh, I should place my money in this bank account, or I'm going to have a good day today, I'm going to meet my one true love. If you're actually making real life decisions on that, that's when it becomes problematic.
So what we now need to know from people listening is, based on everything that's just happened, knowing that your birthday is in July, but not knowing when in July,
oh no,
whether Leon is a Cancer or a Leo. Oh, let's see if you can guess.
As soon as you started that attitude. Sentence, I knew where that question was going.
Okay, so what's the real constellation of the month, seeing as I can't steal it and have it be below just for my birthday?
We mentioned it last month as part of our story related to Hydra, but I thought we'd make it the real star.
It gets its own moment to shine.
Yeah, it gets its own moment, and that's Corvus the Crow.
Ah, the Crow.
And the reason I've made it the constellation of the month is because it's a lot easier to see than Hydra.
Yes.
So if you remember, we mentioned Hydra's quite a faint constellation, and you kind of need to know.
Sort of very faint. Very long and takes up quite a lot of the sky.
Yes, that's right. So yeah, it is definitely large and impressive. It's just kind of, I don't want to say unimpressive, but hard to look at. But
yes, hard to spot.
Hard to spot, yes.
But impressive once you get it.
Yes, that's right. Corvus, on the other hand, is very easy to look at. And in fact, I, before I really was the space expert that I am now, I used to look at Corvus every night when I was out walking, and I'd be like, oh, I wonder what constellation that is. And I eventually looked it up and went, oh, yeah, it's really, really distinct, really obvious. Yeah. It's basically a diamond-shaped pattern of stars.
So I think that it looks like a meat cleaver.
How so?
Well, so because you've kind of got, or a sail, like a sail of a sailing boat.
Yeah, I can see a sail of a sailing boat.
Yeah.
Oh, a meat cleaver, right. So yeah, I thought you meant a meat, like, hammer.
No, not a tenderizer, no, like a cleaver. A cleaver. It looks like a big blade.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I know, I see what you mean. Yeah, you've got this diamond-shaped pattern of stars, which is not perfectly rectangular, it's not perfectly diamond, it's kind of just a misshapen diamond.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, there is a little star off to the side as well, which...
Looks like a handle.
Yeah, it looks like a handle.
Yeah.
That's a good one, actually, because, for the record, Corvus the crow means it's often interpreted as a crow, a bird.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that I found out about Corvus, which sort of relates to the conversation we were having about Leo and the seasons and all of that as well, is that we actually know about it as a crow from the year 1100 BC. So the Babylonians, so Babylonia is present-day sort of Iraq, Syria, Iran area. So there's actually a lot of recorded information about Babylonian star signs. So Centaurus is also a Babylonian constellation, but they saw it as a bison man instead of half man, half horse. So because there's quite a lot of writing that actually survived from that era. So the Babylonians also saw it as a raven, and it was sacred to the god Adad, who is the god of rain. At the time, in Iraq, Syria, Iran, it would have risen just before autumn time, so signifying that the rain is going to come.
There we go.
Which is really fitting for us in Australia.
Yeah.
Because now, in the winter, it is rain time. So I thought that that was quite good.
That is quite nice. well, there you go. So if you want to see Corvus, it's quite high up in the southwestern sky during the month of July.
Okay, so if I have found the Milky Way, am I looking... So I'm facing south. We're always facing south because it's easy to find, because we can find our Southern Cross. We can face south. I've got the Milky Way stretching out in front of me. Am I looking above or below the Milky Way to find Corvus?
This is assuming you're facing south.
Yep.
Yeah, you can see the Milky Way stretching above your head, which kind of loosely stretches from southwest to northeast.
Okay.
You know, it depends on time of day, but like I'm thinking about early evening, 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Yep.
It's the Milky Way will be almost in a vertical above your head, and it's just off to the right.
Yeah, cool.
And we're looking for this meat cleaver or this diamond-shaped pattern of stars. But yeah, now that you say that, I can see a meat cleaver more than I can see a bird. But also, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see a bird there either. It's a very forgiving shape.
Yeah.
You know, you look at some of the constellations and you're like, really?
Yeah, and then there are some constellations which just have so many stars. In all honesty, you could just make whatever shape you wanted out of all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Corvus does, I think, meat cleaver at first, and then... You know, I've had friends who are really into boats who are like, no, that's a sailing ship. But when we think about it and stand back and like, oh no, now you've said so, I can see a crow.
There we go. So, I'm going to look for the meat cleaver tonight. So that wraps up Constellation of the Month.
I think it's time for Spaceflight Focus. What is going on up with people sending stuff into space?
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of months.
Oh.
But rather than sending things up to space, I want to talk about something about bringing stuff back from space.
Ooh.
And that is China and the Chang'e 6 lunar expedition.
Oh.
So China has a space program. We don't hear as much about it as we do about the other international space programs.
I feel like there's a little bit of international competitivity. That's not a word. Competitivity?
Competition.
Competition? Yeah. Yeah. Between, I think it's... Because China has its own space station. Like, everyone else has the ISS and they're all happy with the ISS. And then there's also the Chinese space station. I feel like there's a little bit of rivalry. So we tend to hear a little bit less about the Chinese space ventures.
Yes, we do. And there's a huge amount of tension between... It's mostly US and China.
Yeah, a bit of global politics.
Yeah, China has their own space station because they are not allowed to go to the International Space Station because the US won't cooperate with them.
Yeah.
So that's why. And then Russia's this kind of awkward middleman who's not really on the best of terms with the US either.
Yeah.
So as a result, we tend not to hear much about it, but this is a civilian. This was not a military mission. There's a lot of suspicion about Chinese military activity in space as well.
Yeah.
But the Chang'e 6 was a lunar mission designed to go to the far side of the moon, So, yeah, the side of the moon that we can't see from Earth.
The Pink Floyd side.
No.
That's the dark side.
Yes. That's another rant for another day. There is no such thing. There is a night side of the moon.
We'll have to have a space in pop culture section so that we can talk about how much it gets it wrong.
Yeah, and misconceptions. Good album, though.
Great album.
Yeah, went to the far side of the moon. So when you look at the moon, there's something you always knew, just not until someone spells it out for you. We've only ever seen half of the moon from Earth with our eyes, and that's just because the moon, its rotation is in sync with its orbit, meaning it rotates exactly once for every time it orbits the Earth exactly once. And what that means is we always see the same side of the moon from here on the ground.
The same side of the moon is always facing Earth.
That's right. And however, the Chang'e 6 was designed to go to the far side of the moon, so we couldn't see it, which presents a huge its own set of complications. Like, how is that any different to just going to the near side? Isn't it just hard? Yes, it is. But the other hard part is that if you've got something on the near side of the moon, you can still point an antenna at it and talk to it. Whereas to talk to something on the far side of the moon, you need a separate satellite as a relay to communicate with this.
Yeah, so basically all of the satellite communications that we use at the moment need clear line of sight to talk to things, and they can't get through the moon.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They physically cannot get through the moon. So I guess like the easiest way to compare that would be if anyone's familiar with using like a GPS or a satellite phone, and if you've got a dedicated GPS device, if it can't see the sky, it's going to struggle because it's using satellite.
Yeah, so that's true.
Same thing with trying to send instructions or information to something that's on the far side of the moon. There's a moon in the way.
Yes, thousands of tons of rock in the way. Yes, but it was successful. So it launched on the 3rd of May, so a couple of months ago, actually, and then touched down, and quite successfully, all autonomously. There's no one on board. This is just a robot. And the main exciting thing about it that's sort of the really exciting news, bringing things back, is that it collected a sample of about 2 kilos of rock and sand from the surface of the moon, put it in a little capsule, sent it back up into space, and brought it back to Earth. And it just on Tuesday, a couple of days ago, that little capsule landed back in Mongolia, and now we have a sample from the far side of the moon.
That sort of thing sounds simultaneously really basic and really impressive.
Yeah.
It's like, so we sent something to the moon and brought it back. We've done that like loads of times. It's like, no, but it's the other side of the moon.
The other side, and it was all autonomous. There was no people and nothing. That was really cool.
Did we ever send people to the far side of the moon?
No, not landing. So people in spacecraft orbited to the far side of the moon.
Yeah. Have people walked over to the far side of the moon?
No.
So they've only ever stayed in sight of planet Earth.
Yes, that's right, for the people on the surface, yeah. When they're in the spacecraft on the far side of the moon, there were moments of radio blackout.
Yeah.
And that was the first one on Apollo 8 when they went behind the moon for the first time ever.
Yeah.
And everyone was really nervous. Are they going to reestablish contact afterwards? And they did.
Good.
But yeah, exactly.
This is the first time that we've had samples from the other side of the moon.
Side of the moon. Yeah.
And I guess then we're looking forward to seeing how different they are, if at all.
Yes, because that's right.
I guess it could be, moon rock is moon rock, or it could be something really weird.
It could be. Yeah, so this is particularly interesting because it was the far side, but also quite far south, just in the lunar South Pole. Mm-hmm. But South Pole and the moon is like anything below 60 degrees latitude, so it's quite a generous definition of South Pole.
Yeah.
Inside this enormous crater called the Apollo Basin, or sometimes the Aitken Basin, things like something like that. And that's really interesting because when you look at the near side of the moon, and you can see those dark parts, and you know people call the man in the moon and things like that.
I see a rabbit.
Yeah, I see a rabbit too. Those we understand to be formed by enormous collisions that sort of gouged out huge craters in the moon that then filled with lava, and that's what caused this dark region here. And then in the South Pole, this huge basin that this has collected samples from, they're kind of unsure how that basin formed and when it formed. It seemed to have formed after those dark parts we can see on the moon. So we're trying to understand the history of the moon based on what we can collect from these rocks. So, yeah, we're expecting them to actually be a bit different because, all of the Apollo missions that were the only ones that landed people on the moon, they collected rock samples from up and around those dark areas that we were talking about. Not just those, but around that near side.
Yeah.
But, we haven't got any rock samples from down south. And this is a particularly unique area down south that will tell us a little bit more about about the history of the moon, hopefully. But yeah, we kind of need to look at the rocks to find out.
Yeah.
We can make guesses. So scientists think that after the moon formed, there was this increased period of asteroid bombardment called the late heavy bombardment. But, you know, evidence for that is very hard to come across because this happened more than 4 billion years ago.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to figure out the details. And it's
hard enough finding evidence of stuff that happened 4 billion years ago on planet Earth, let alone in space.
That's right, yeah. And so, but that's kind of what we're hoping to look for. But also another fascinating idea, which is still a topic of hot debate, is where did the water on Earth come from?
Yes.
And one idea is that these comets and asteroids that were hitting the Earth and the Moon and presumably all the other planets during the late heavy bombardment also brought with them all the water that we now have.
Right.
And so if they find abnormally high quantities of water in this rock sample from the Moon, that may give us a hint that, yeah, maybe these comets did bring Earth's water, which is fascinating. You think we go to this barren, dead crater on the Moon from 4 billion years ago and it might tell us about water on Earth and life, and, you know, as we know, water on, on life needs water. And so these apparently boring and mundane missions to collect dirt
off a grey rock might actually change how we view the history of life on our Earth. Planet.
Yeah, 100% correct. Yeah, it might. So obviously, that's not overpromise.
Might just be some boring rocks.
Yeah, might just be some dirt. But you know, that's what we do. You gotta. You'll never know if you never try.
Exactly. So that's not the only thing in spaceflight. You said that we've had a busy time.
So it was a few weeks ago now, but there was, of course, the big Starship launch.
Uh-huh.
Starship Flight 4. I won't go through too many details because we've covered these before.
Yeah.
But this one was particularly exciting because the last time we spoke about this was just after Flight 3, which was a couple of months ago, and just a few weeks ago we had Flight 4. Mm-hmm. And in Flight 3, what happened was the spaceship, it got to space, Starship, this enormous rocket, it got to space.
Boeing?
No, this is Boeing's SpaceX.
This is SpaceX,
Oh, don't worry, we'll come back to Boeing later.
Oh, no. Okay, so there was some Boeing on hold, Starship, the SpaceX connection.
SpaceX connection. So, quick summary, it's a rocket that's 110 metres tall, and it's in two stages. The first 70 metres separates after a couple of minutes when it runs out of fuel. That flies back to base and ditches. Eventually it will land and be reused. That's the plan.
Yep.
And then the second half goes on to space. And then, mission three ended when the lower half, the booster, was attempting to land in the ocean, but it blew up on the way down. And then the second half that made its way all the way to space was attempting to re-enter through Earth's atmosphere and come back down into the Indian Ocean, not far off the coast of Western Australia. And it also blew up. No people.
Okay, good.
Yeah, all robotic. And it just burnt up because re-entering from the Earth's atmosphere is just so difficult because you're dealing with such extreme speeds that things just want to melt. So test number four took place a few weeks ago.
Okay.
And it was almost, I would call it a success.
What?
So we had the launch, the booster separated, it flew back to base and it made its way and it fired up its engines and it, quote, landed, unquote, in the ocean just off Mexico.
So it splashed down.
It splashed down,
yeah.
Which was what it was intended. It wasn't trying to get back to the ground yet.
So this is not, because I know that SpaceX, like I've seen videos of like landing rockets upright on platforms.
Yes.
This was not that. This is just having a splish.
That's right, yeah. So this is a completely different rocket.
Okay.
So yeah, the ones you see land and they're really amazing, the Falcon 9 rockets, they've got that down to an art form.
Okay.
And they eventually want to do the same for this, for Starship.
Yeah, but we're still in earlier stage of this rocket development because it's so much bigger than the Falcon rockets.
Yes, that's right. So much bigger, a lot more moving parts, a lot more complexity.
Right.
And so they're just seeing that they can go through the motions of turning the engines on, slowing the speed down.
Yep.
But, you know, if they get it wrong, it just splashes in the ocean. It doesn't land on their expensive equipment or on their boat or anything
that's
like
fair.
That.
Are they going to retrieve the bit that splashed in the ocean?
Not at the moment, not this one. Whoa. So, yeah, it's just
so there's
sunk.
So there's some space fun out there in the ocean.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me if someone very rich hires a big boat and goes and digs up some of it.
Yeah, fair.
So that was actually, believe it or not, the less exciting part of the flight. The really exciting part was the second half, the ship that went all the way to space and then attempted re-entry.
Attempted.
So this ship's about 50 metres long, which is already enormous.
Huge.
It's huge.
I can't even conceptualise what 50 metres long is. How big are we talking in like football fields?
Well, I was just about to say, here's an analogy that won't be very helpful for you, but in AFL, we have the 50-metre line.
Okay, so, that far.
Yeah, so just imagine that.
I will.
Lying down, it's from the goal square to the 50-metre line.
go and try and find myself an oval to look at later.
So it's very large, and it's travelling at 27,000 kilometres an hour in space, and it needs to use just wind resistance to lose most of that speed. So it's not hard to, you know, turn your engines on, burn up a lot of fuel and slow down that way.
Yeah.
But it already used all of its fuel to get to space. Oh. It doesn't have any fuel left. So the only way for it to come back down is to punch through the atmosphere. And problem is, when you're moving at that speed, it's not just like a little bit rough. It's things get so hot that air in front of the ship gets compressed so much it ionizes and becomes plasma and becomes several thousand degrees. And
yeah, well, I've seen pictures of re-entry from the Apollo missions where they've got that little capsule and they've got like the heat pads all over it, and it's sort of barreling through, and it looks like there's flames like coming over the front of it.
Yes, that's right. Exactly what Starship has to endure.
Yeah.
And this, what was particularly amazing about this is that we got basically a live stream of the whole thing the whole way down, and it was amazing because you could see the plasma build up, and you could watch the speed slowly declining. The way Starship keeps itself from tumbling out of control is it has flaps on the side, just little like really itty bitty stubby wings,
like
basically
an airplane.
Well, think
is
about
it, like when you're landing in an airplane and they put the little flaps up.
Sort of, but imagine the wings themselves are the flaps.
Okay, so we've just got little stubby.
But they are stubby. They're not like hugely.
They're not wings, they're flaps.
They're not wings, they're flaps, that's okay. Right. They're only a couple of metres long. But that's enough to steer the spaceship, and that's what matters. The problem is to make them be able to steer like that, you need a gap in the heat protection.
Oh, because, no.
Yeah, and so there was this big question, will the insulation on there survive re-entry?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Spoilers. Just barely.
Okay.
So there's this amazing camera footage looking at the flaps, and you can start to see after about 5 minutes of punching through this plasma, there's this little leak that starts to...
Yeah, a little eddy into the low pressure zone.
And at this point, I was watching, I'm like, they've lost it. It's going to...
Yeah,
it's going to explode. Catastrophically fail, and we're just going to lose signal straight away. And you could see this little leak turned into a big, big red wound, and then you could start seeing pieces of the flap melting off. Like,
no.
And this thing's made of steel. Steel doesn't melt at a very low temperature. It's more than 1,000 degrees. And so that shows you how hot this plasma is.
Oh, the little flap.
Yeah. And then what happened was the camera that was watching this, it got so exposed to the plasma that it cracked and it got covered in dirt, and we couldn't see what was going on because it was nighttime as well.
Oh, no. Oh, it's so intense.
It was so intense. And then just as well, like, this isn't going to happen. It passed through a particularly wet area and of clouds, and we got a little bit of a clearer vision, and suddenly we could see the flap moving again. So even though it was half melted, it still had control of it.
Oh, my goodness.
And it survived. It made it all the way down to the ocean, and, you know, the last few kilometres the plasma sort of wore off, and that was the real test. After that, you know, suppose it tried to relight its engines and it exploded. It doesn't matter. They made it through re-entry.
Yes.
They almost
that was
melted.
What they wanted.
Yeah, they almost melted. There were, you know, half, you know, however many people were watching this live stream, just clenched butt cheeks.
Yeah. No. I'm going to call that. Yep. That is a spaceflight success.
Yeah. So it fired its engines. It splashed down in the ocean and it survived, and, you know, just barely. But it was some of the most amazing footage that we've ever seen of a spacecraft.
That's amazing. I bet that has informed so much.
Oh yeah.
Like, there's thousands of researchers around the world right now who just went, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone, and not just researchers. Every foreign government who's, quote, not interested, unquote,
oh,
in what's going on.
No.
Yeah,
they don't mind.
Yeah, everyone was watching that very closely because, yeah, Starship is just, you know, next generation spaceship.
Oh, that's so awesome. Because I guess it's big enough to... Because one of the big things about spaceflight in general is that it's not hugely commercially viable. Like we were talking about last month with, like, space tourism and stuff, there's loads of controversy, you know, pros and cons around it. But the bigger the ship you're sending, the more economical it becomes.
Yes, that's right.
So... this could be, well, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Big a very, deal. Very big deal.
Yeah. And so that's the sort of goal. So when people talk about space flight, they talk about price per kilo to orbit.
Yeah.
How many dollars per kilo? Because that's really what it is. It's the weight that matters.
Yeah.
So space flight during the space shuttle was around about $70,000 a kilo. Whereas on the Falcon 9, it's about $5,000 a kilo. So it's, you know, it's an order of magnitude better. And then by the time Starship comes around, I mean, obviously they'll probably still charge a minimal operation price.
Yeah.
But, you know, that might come down to hundreds of dollars per kilo, which doesn't, you know, doesn't sound cheap, but it's
revolutionary.
It's an order of magnitude. It puts it in the realm of, you know, individuals and putting things up there, which may or may not be a good thing, but it also becomes a lot cheaper to put an entire new space station. The International Space Station is probably the most expensive thing ever built in history, hundreds of billions of dollars, but a lot of that is just because of the inefficient price per launch, price per kilo when it was built.
Whereas
you could launch the same amount of cargo in, you know, for five or six launches of Starship.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might cost you 1/100th of the price.
But I guess, how old is the International Space Station now?
It started construction in 2001, I believe. So yeah. Some of the oldest parts are really quite old.
Yeah, so I guess we're also coming to the point where talking about stuff like the International Space Station, you do get to a point with certain things where it becomes cheaper to build a new one from scratch than it does to gradually, bit by bit, replace the old one.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, yeah, we're getting to a point where it might be, I mean, not, I don't think in the next 10 years, but getting towards new ISS time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. The ISS is currently not really funded beyond the end of this decade.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's right. And also the next generation, I don't think, will be ISSs so much as commercial space stations.
Yeah.
Which again presents its own raft of ethical problems, but that's a story for another few years from now.
Yeah. Well, we might have gotten the ships to the point where the ethical discussions are viable.
Yes.
Yeah. So is that all for our flights?
I think that's probably a nice amount for now. I will just draw everyone's attention, though. It doesn't sound very exciting, but there is one exciting launch that hopefully will be taking place during July, which is the Ariane 6.
I haven't heard of Ariane before at all.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one because you're from over there. So the Ariane 6 is the European Space Agency's new launch vehicle.
Oh, that's exciting.
So Ariane is a family of rockets. There's the Ariane. You know, going back, they retired the Ariane 5. It's, you know, a design of rocket.
Yeah. And so like the Falcon, yeah. like the Starship, the yeah, Ariane right. is yeah. one of those.
100% correct. The Ariane 5 was very, very famously reliable launch vehicle.
Yeah.
It actually launched the James Webb Space Telescope.
Yes.
And a bunch of other famous launches, except for its very first launch, which had a bit of a problem and blew up after a minute. We just don't talk about that one. that's a story for another day. But yeah, they retired the Ariane 5 a bit too soon. The Ariane 6 wasn't quite ready, and so the European Space Agency has been without a launch vehicle for about a year now.
Have they just been borrowing the...
They've been putting them on other launches. It's not that they retired too soon. They had another rocket called the Vega C, which was their sort of light lift launch vehicle.
Right.
But the problem is that just after they retired the Ariane 5, they found a problem with Vega. So they had to ground Vega before Ariane 6 was ready. Long story short, they're finally ready to launch Ariane 6, hopefully during July, and it'll be a nice welcome return for the European Space Agency to the launch business.
Good. So let's keep an eye out for Ariane.
Ariane 6.
Now,
that's right.
Thank you, Leon.
I have a question for you.
Oh.
Because I believe it's time. I would like to learn something about what space words mean. It's
space
time
words?
For Deep Sky Dictionary.
Deep Sky Dictionary.
I am not sure I know how to answer that.
So, Deep Sky Dictionary this month. So this is still relatively new. It's
yes.
pretty self-explanatory, so I'll tell you what it is anyway. So Deep Sky Dictionary is when we find a word that space people use and tell you what it actually means, because a lot of the time, space folks in general like to throw around a lot of jargon. So this word, our word of the month, is parallax.
Ooh, parallax.
Good word. Yeah, I think it's because it's got an X in it. Yeah. It sounds very, very mysterious.
The Parallax Files.
Yeah, Parallax is very sci-fi.
Way less interesting than the original.
Now, even though it sounds like a very sci-fi word, it is used quite commonly in non-sci-fi situations, including in, it's actually used in videography as well.
Wow.
Because what parallax is it's when the position or direction of an object appears to be different when you view it from different positions.
Yes.
Which sounds really confusing, but it's actually not. So the easiest way to think about parallax is if you hold a finger up out in front of you and you look beyond it, sort of to a point in the background, and close one eye.
Yep.
And then swap eyes.
Oh, so like close the other eye and open.
Yeah. And you can see that your finger appears to move between the two different... like between two different places when you're opening and closing a different eye.
Yeah, compared to the background.
Compared to the background. Your finger's not moving. It just looks like it's moved because you're viewing it from two different positions. You're viewing it from one eye, which is slightly further to the left of your face, and then another eye, which is slightly further to the right, unless you don't have two eyes, in which case you wouldn't experience this parallax. So... No, you just wouldn't.
Yeah.
So it happens in videography because of the difference between when you're using a viewfinder and what's actually being seen through the lens. So if you're looking at a camera, if you're looking through a very small like glass viewfinder, you'll see something, but the lens is slightly further down and forwards than the actual viewfinder. So what's actually coming through the lens is going to be slightly different to the viewfinder. until the advent of digital, you know, I think that digital viewfinders have changed that a little bit, just because they can see what the actual lens is seeing. But in a sort of old school viewfinder, it's going to look a little bit different. So why is this relevant to space? Because we look at things from different positions. We look at things that are very far away from us. We look at things out in space. We look at stars, and stars, depending on where you're looking at them from, could look like they're in very different positions compared to their background.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. And that's actually how we can measure the distance to some of the nearest stars to us, is by exploiting the parallax. And
oh, so we can actually use this parallax to help us measure distances. It's not an inconvenience. It's helpful.
Yes, absolutely right. It's for the nearer stars to the sun, yeah. And I say nearest as in within like 1,000 light years.
Oh, that's
And it comes down to the fact that, yeah, it doesn't. Although you might not feel it, we're on a moving frame of reference. The Earth is screaming around the sun,
yeah.
At, I don't know, 35 kilometres per second or something like that. Long story short, it goes around the sun once a year. That's yeah. The definition. But the idea is, I want you to imagine the sun. The sun is in front of you, and then off to the right-hand side, you've got the Earth. Like, you know, just it doesn't have to be to scale, but the sun's in front of you, the Earth is off to the right, and then in the background, there's a star that you want to measure the distance to.
Yeah. Can it be Alpha Centauri?
Sure, let's go. Okay. Alpha Centauri. And what you do is you make a note of where Alpha Centauri is on the sky,
mm-hmm.
from your position on Earth.
Yep.
And then you wait 6 months.
Oh, so now
the Earth is
on the left-hand side.
It's on the left, yeah. And you do the same thing again. And just like before, where we were holding up our finger and closing one eye and opening the other,
yeah.
that's simulating in this example,
yeah.
the Earth moving from one side of the sun to the other.
So in this case, my nose would be the sun. Whichever eye is open is the position of the Earth, and Alpha Centauri is my finger.
Yes, that's exactly right. Okay. And yeah, so from your position on Earth, you take those measurements 6 months apart, and you measure the star, Alpha Centauri, will be in a slightly different spot.
Yes.
And
so we measure the parallax?
You measure the parallax, because that's an angle on the sky that you measure.
Right.
And I should clarify, what are you measuring compared to? You're measuring it compared to, now there is an inbuilt assumption, you're measuring it compared to stars that are further away, that themselves, they're so far away that they don't have much parallax.
Right.
It's like having imagine if your arm was 20 metres long.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really see much of a parallax if your hand's that far away. But, you know, compared to something that's a bit closer, like Alpha Centauri, you can measure this amount that it changes. So what you've measured is an angle. One thing you do know is the distance from the Earth to the Sun.
Right.
And so what you can do is you can draw a triangle. You know the distance of one of the sides. You know the angle of... It's a very pointy triangle.
Cheeky bit of trigonometry.
Yeah, you draw a triangle from Earth the first time you took the measurement and then Earth 6 months later.
Yep.
And then... So that's your base. And then it's a very, very long, skinny triangle because
the third point out to Alpha Centauri.
And you know what that angle is now because you've measured it.
Because I measured it.
Do some trigonometry and you can measure the distances to stars.
That's very impressive.
Well, that leaves us time for just one more segment.
One final segment. The best segment ever invented for radio. Space picture of the month.
Space picture of the month.
Alrighty. I will go first. I am currently sending you my space picture of the month. I think you'll find it fairly familiar.
Ooh, okay, wow.
What are you seeing, Leon? I know you know exactly what this is.
Yes. Now, how to describe it without just launching into it. It's important to actually describe the background. The surrounding, it's a rectangular picture and the background is black.
Black.
It's just black.
Yeah.
However, center of it is a huge orange disc, which I know to be the sun.
It is.
So it looks almost like proportionally, not colour-wise, but proportionally it looks a bit like the Japanese flag.
Yes. Yeah, I think maybe even the circle's slightly bigger than the... But that is...
Yeah, if you're trying to visualise this...
Yes, yes.
However,
I was going to say it looks like an orange... But that's where I thought you were going. Completely incorrect.
We have this big orange sun in the middle of the picture. And you can actually see a couple of sunspots. There's these tiny little black smudges on the surface of the sun. However, that's really not the bit that's drawing the attention, because it looks like about a quarter of the sun has been eaten. There's this huge black misshapen, almost like potato-shaped hole in the image of the sun. But I know that there's not a huge potato-shaped hole in the sun. So what are we looking at, Beth?
We're looking at an eclipse. Last month, I brought in a picture of the Earth and the Moon from Mars, I brought in a picture of the Earth and specifically the moon Luna from Mars. This is another picture of a moon from Mars.
Oh, right. I thought you were going to tell me that this picture here is of
No, last month's picture was of the Earth and Luna.
Ah, gotcha.
This month's picture is of a moon.
It's of a moon, yes.
But not Luna. This is a picture of a solar eclipse from Mars. I always have to take a second before I say solar or lunar eclipse because both of them involve the sun and the moon. So it's like, wait, which one's which? This is a solar eclipse from Mars. So this is Phobos, and Phobos is one of Mars's two moons, but Mars's moons are quite different from ours in a number of ways. So one is that Phobos is potato-shaped. Our moon is nice and round.
Right.
So I think that's just to do with relative size. Our moon's quite a lot bigger than Mars's moons, and some things in space need a certain amount of gravity to be able to sort of maintain a round shape to pull themselves round. So Mars's moons aren't quite big enough to do that. So it's a lovely potato. Mm. It's also, one, quite a small potato, and two, here on Earth, and I think we have mentioned this before when we've spoken about eclipses, we are actually really lucky that we have eclipses the way that we do, because the sun and the moon just happen to look about the same size in our sky.
Mm.
It is pure luck, or probably not. There's probably some in-depth scientific... No, maybe just luck.
It's coincidence.
Yep. So purely coincidence that our sun and our moon look to us the roughly the same size in our sky. It's just to do with the distance that the moon and the sun are from us here on Earth. On Mars, the moons are a lot smaller. Mars is a lot further away, which means that those relative distances mean that Mars's moons cannot totally eclipse the sun. They cannot totally get in the way like our moon can.
Right. And that's why we're looking at this. Sure, I can see this potato-shaped dark thing, which is Phobos, but the sun is around it on all sides. Like,
yes, absolutely. So it's not like a bite has been taken out of the side of the sun.
No.
It looks like someone has painted a black patch in the middle of the sun. So yeah, during a Martian solar eclipse, you can still see the sun the whole way around the moon, and the moon looks like a potato. Yeah, I've just been enjoying my little theme of photos from Mars.
Photos from Mars. Wow, all right, you might have to go a trio next month.
I might do.
Yeah, so it is a really...
Google's photos taken from Mars.
It's a really, really good photo. Yeah, really, really nice choice there, Beth.
Thank you. What have you got for me?
All right, let me...
Well, this doesn't look like it's in space at all, Leon. All right, so what I'm looking at here is it looks like a warehouse. So it's sort of quite a big open space, quite industrial-looking background. There's lots of stuff around the edges. I could probably look at the stuff for a long time, but, you know, like forklifts, that kind of thing. And then in the middle, dominating this picture, there is a big, weird square. So this big, weird square is made out of four... It looks like triangles of mylar, like the shiny reflective fabric. So it looks like, not quite like tin foil, that have been stretched across this floor with four poles in between those triangles, a little bit like a kite. So I don't know what on earth is going on here, Leon.
Good description. I was thinking it looks like, you know, when you cut a sandwich into triangles.
Yes, yeah, it looks like a big silver sandwich cut into triangles.
Yeah, but however, you dropped in the word kite, which I think is probably the best description of this. But it's a very special type of kite. So this is a NASA spacecraft called the Advanced Composite Solar Sail System, or ACS-3, as it's sometimes called, and it's exactly that. It's a spacecraft that is designed to launch. If you look right in the middle of the triangle, you can see a little box about the size of a microwave where the guy is crouching in front of.
Oh, I thought that was just a stack of bricks.
No, so that's the spaceship. And those mylar sheets are the sails. Yes, they're sails. And the booms, or the framework upon which it's holding on, is all designed to coil up and get stuffed inside that little box. You wouldn't believe it all fits in there.
Genuinely, with the scale of this picture,
it's 9 meters on a side, so it's 9 meters by 9 meters when fully deployed. So from the center to the edge is about 4.5 meters. So that's two and a bit people.
Yeah, depending on how tall your people are.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
2 6-foot people. Wait, 2 2-meter people.
Yeah.
Ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very large, but yeah, you think how's that?
So genuinely, this little thing in the middle, I did not think was worth mentioning, which is why I didn't mention it, because I thought it was just a stack of bricks propping up the the sticks. Framework.
Yeah. No, that's the spaceship. So the spaceship launches. It's the size of a microwave, thereabouts. And when it's in space, in fact, it launched on the 23rd of April, so a few months ago. And the plan is to deploy those booms and that sun, that big sail. It's a solar sail system. So rather than using conventional propellant like engines or anything like that, you know, conventional propellant engines, what an idea. It's designed to catch sunlight, and that's why the surface is very reflective.
Yeah.
There was a huge discovery when this was figured out in the late 19th century, but light carries momentum with it. So you know when you're at the in the beach and you're surfing and you've got it and you're holding up a kite,
yeah,
and the wind, even though the wind is invisible, you know that it's there. Yeah. You can feel it pushes things, and that's how kites work, because the wind, the particles of the air push on the kite. Well, the same thing is being experimented with here.
Getting into photons?
Yes, photons. So sunlight itself, it's a minuscule amount of energy, but
is it a wave? Is it a particle? Yes.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. It carries momentum. And the idea is by catching enough of these photons, you can use it to steer and operate your spacecraft without conventional fuel. And that's what's really exciting about this.
So it's solar powered, but not in the way that you would think solar powered to mean, as in it's not like we're generating electricity from the sun, which is then powering an engine. It is literally a sail that catches the momentum of light.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Exactly right. Now, interestingly, it's not the first spaceship of its kind like this. There have been prototypes of this tested. What they're testing here is the materials and the deployment. So the idea, because you look at this and you're like, there is no way that fits in that box.
Yeah, no.
But it does. And the whole thing coils up and folds up. And what they're testing is that are these materials, because, you know, only you can't take a very brittle material and roll it up like that.
No.
So, yeah, what they're really testing is the materials. Can you build a sturdy enough frame out of these materials that can fold up and coil and then unfold?
Just need one of those pop-up tents.
Yeah, exactly.
Just one of those.
Yeah, one of those. It's a bit like a pop-up tent where you're like, there is no way, you know, when you pull it out of the bag and it never gets back in the bag ever again?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's
like, oh no, you just have to come along and twist it in this really specific way and then it's tiny.
Yeah, yeah, that, oh God. Yeah, those things are, give you nightmares. But that's really what they're testing here is, are these materials fit for the job?
Right.
And so it's just yet another step in a big long line of what, you know, may potentially be one day fleets of these things, because they're a lot smaller and a lot easier to build than big, complex spacecraft. But, you know, if you want to send 30 or 40 of them to Jupiter to get some nice...
Yeah, some data.
Whatever. Can you do that, and how efficiently, and are these materials good? Because can you imagine if you had to make the spacecraft six times as big to fit everything in, you can only launch half a dozen, and then suddenly your price goes up and we come back to the cost per launch.
Yep.
Whereas if you can fit 100 of these on a rocket...
Yeah, the smaller... Also, I imagine the smaller we can make them, the more effective they actually are once those sails are deployed.
Yes, because they're less massive, that's right. Yeah. These are not good for huge energy burns, like to rapidly change direction and to do anything like that.
No, this is never going to get a person into space.
No, that's right. But to gently, slowly position yourself to travel to another planet for, you know, you don't really have a huge time span. You know, if you've got some robotic equipment on board, you can do that with one of these.
Awesome.
And so they're pretty popular in still what I would call sci-fi / speculation.
Yes, but, you know, speculative fiction.
Speculative fiction, but soon, hopefully, to become a reality, because they're
making one.
Yeah, and it's not even a case of when the spacecraft stops working that the solar sail stops working. The sun keeps shining, and the solar sail keeps getting hit by sunlight, so it will work forever. Obviously, the further away you get from the sun, the less efficient. But yeah, I thought it was very cool.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Leon. Alrighty, I think that brings us to the end of our podcast this month.
I think it does. It's been a hell of a conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again for having me, Leon.
Thanks for being here, Beth. I've had a time and a half.
I've had two and a half times.
Oh. Well, next month we'll have to do better. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next month where we talk about the space news for August. If you want to hear more interesting space news, check out the website particle.scitech.org.au for more information.